This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. We've had a lot of people ask questions about flight training, what types of programs you can get into, and I've got my own opinions on that, and I actually changed some this spring. I was down through Bend, Oregon, and I had a chance to sit down with Carl Baldessari, who's one of the administrators for the Central Oregon Community College Aviation Program. And they're a two-year degree program, Part 141 school. Sometimes these interviews are hit or miss in terms of the quality of the information I get, and Carl was extremely good. I think I actually picked the absolute perfect person to talk to about it. He wasn't plugging his program, but had a lot of really good information that I think we pull out in this interview. These two-year programs, a nice thing about them, and this was talking to Carl again, they can set up financial aid all the way through, and if you're prior military and have the GI Bill paying for it, this is a great way to go. Some of the schools, some of these two-year programs don't include the flight training in that financial aid package, and that was something that was a surprise to me. So I think these two-year programs differ dramatically depending on the school you go to, so that it's worth looking into the school carefully and listen to this interview, because Carl has some really good insight into the differences between two-year programs. Going with the four-year program, I personally think they're all pretty darn good. You're going to pay a lot for them, though. But four-year education, you know, getting a bachelor's these days costs a fair amount. So if you want to go that route, it's certainly viable. Keep in mind, most aviation jobs, when you get out of school, you're not making a lot of money for quite a few years. And I'm not sure that that four-year aviation program is going to get you that much further than someone who did a normal, did a bachelor's at a non-aviation school and then got their flight training somewhere else for a lower cost. I don't think the airlines really care that much. Although a recognized school, you may make some good connections that can get you a job down the road. And I'm going to put just a shameless plug in for the Central Oregon Community College, which I did earlier too, but Bend is an awesome town to live in. The weather's good, so you can get consistent training. And I have a couple friends who've gone there, and a couple of our members have gone there, and they all have spoken very highly of not just the Central Oregon Community College, but the flight school that does the contract training within their program. So, anyway, it's a great talk with Carl. I learned a lot about aviation education, so I hope you guys enjoy this. And any questions, feel free to throw them in there at the bottom of the comments, and I'll see if I can answer them appropriately or try to get back to Carl and see if he has some answers. I think aviation education is important. I think more people should get more information before they throw their money at a flight school. So thanks for listening. This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm in Bend, Oregon, sitting down with Carl, who's the program director at Central Oregon Community College. And we're going to talk about education in aviation and sort of what your options are out there if you're going to start flying or if you're going to continue your education, and some things that COCC may have coming up in the future. I do want to talk about the drone programs. All right. I think that's awesome. Carl's background is Coast Guard.
Correct.
So you had a whole full career in the Coast Guard before you ended up getting into education.
True. A little stint in aviation manufacturing between the two.
Okay. What drew you to aviation education?
Well, it was somewhat of a natural fit, going back to my original aviation background. So I kind of growing up in military aviation, it was there's a lot of focus on training. Matter of fact, one of the few areas in aviation where they actually allocate significant amounts of money towards the training budget. You know, they consider that the average budget included 30% training in the helicopter world and the Coast Guard, and about 40% training towards fixed-wing flying. So we grew up in an environment that had a lot of training, a lot of education involved, a lot of continuing education. And so after having retired and done some time in the manufacturing industry, I just got back into this part-time and realized how much I kind of missed, well, number one, the flying, and number two, the ability to actually teach or instruct in a field that I had a great deal of experience and knowledge in after an entire career in the Coast Guard.
Excellent. You're right. You hit on some things I didn't wasn't thinking of so much. In commercial aviation, everybody tries to minimize their training costs.
Right.
And in the military, it's a high percentage of their overall cost of a program.
Absolutely.
And that's a big difference between the civilian world and the military world, I think.
Right.
And so providing a high level of education at the beginning of a pilot's career can be pretty important, because later on in a civilian career, you're not going to get a whole lot of...
Right. I think over the years, that's a big part of what made, you know, military pilots so attractive to the civilian aviation industry. You know, a lot of the training was already done for them. Or not that they could walk directly into a job necessarily, or although in some cases they could, but at least the fact knowing that, okay, they came up in a world that, involved a great deal of training and education, but at the same time involved a great deal of standardization and procedural environment that you know, anybody who's flying an airplane, whether you're Delta Airlines or, you know, the mom and pop company down the road, would hopefully appreciate, you know, the way somebody handled their aircraft and stuff. So
you would try to incorporate some of those ideas in the program here at COCC?
Absolutely. You know, when I first got into this, back into the teaching, first part-time and now full-time, I was kind of surprised when I first started doing it. I assumed they were, you know, because there are other programs like this around the country, and I assumed that the model was pretty much the same all over. A bunch of old retired military guys, you know, go back to teaching, you know, because, you know, either they don't want to fly anymore, or they don't want to fly commercially any longer, or the, maybe they're tired of it altogether, but they like the teaching thing. What I come to find out is that wasn't true. I was being a little naive. Evidently, there are a lot of programs out there that are, as you described earlier, young folks that have just come into the industry, and now they turn right back around, of course, because that's your entry-level job, and now they're teaching.
Right.
So the concept of coming into a program and having, again, a career worth of, in my case, helicopter aviation, and then a partner here that teaches on the fixed-wing side, again, a retired senior naval fighter pilot. His predecessor was an Air Force fighter pilot. That level of experience, at least from the military side of it, doesn't necessarily exist a lot of places. So we think we brought with us a fair amount of, again, that standardization, regimentation, holding students to a pretty high standard and ensuring they maintain that standard. There are programs out there that I think operate equally as well, and there are some that don't. I think I can categorically say the programs that don't do well don't have any of those aspects. I think I'm pretty sure about that.
Right. And you touched on something there. So in the military, often the flight instructors, they have a fair amount of experience. They've been in the military for a while.
Absolutely. Very true. The dynamic is completely switched in the military. Huh. Your junior pilots, with very few exceptions, are not your instructors. It's the senior pilots with more hours, more experience. Those are the ones that actually are in a sense, rewarded with an instructor designation or what they call a flight examiner designation or what they call a standardization pilot designation. They're all different levels. So you aspire to that, actually, in the military, as opposed to accepting it as your first order of duty before you get to do other stuff.
Right, and that would change the whole attitude, too, because I've definitely seen flight instructors who there's an attitude of, like, well, I'm just doing this till I move on.
Right.
And for those of you who are just looking at getting into aviation, often your first job out of a flight school is as a flight instructor, often at the flight school you started at. So part of your duty here is actually overseeing your flight instructors as well, who probably came up through your program.
Several of them, actually more than several of them did, but just by sheer numbers here. So our program here at Central Oregon Community College hovers right around 200 students. Nationally, we're always hoping for growth, but of those 200 students, and because we take students into our program throughout the year, we never graduate a huge slug of students all at once. So it's not going to have 100 students entering this fall, and 2 years later, 100 students graduating. They come up throughout the year. So in any given term, you're graduating, you know, 12, 15, maybe 20 or 25 in a strong term. And, you know, at this point, our employment rate is probably around, probably close to 50% locally. And because of that high level of hiring locally, you see, again, the same students that came through our program are now instructors at our flight providers instructing new students in the program. And we even have seen, at this point, have seen some that have been around long enough where they're already preparing or already have left to their second-tier job, those instructors. So it's kind of nice to see somebody from one day that never touched the controls of an aircraft all the way to the point where they're going off to fly people to and from oil rigs in the Gulf Coast, or they're going to go be, doing tour operations in the Grand Canyon or maybe up to Alaska. So
yeah, that's a nice thing about being in education is you get to see that progression. And it's funny because I see it with this website now. We've had it long enough. I've been talking to enough people that, you see them go on, and we were just talking about Jordy.
Right.
You see them get a job. It's really cool to, it's cool to see that happen.
Oh, yeah, and they're getting them. They're getting the jobs. A young guy came in here just yesterday. He applied. He's 2 weeks short of getting his CFII, and he applied to a tour operator in Zion National Park.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, I was shocked. They called me back and called me for an interview. And I said, oh, that's when he, well, why are you shocked? And he said, because I just didn't think it would ever happen. No prior experience in aviation before he came to this program. Has slammed the program. He's gone through like nobody's business. He's done a great job. 4.0 student. Probably he's done a 2-year program, probably a little bit less than 18 months. And goes out, does a little bit of a phone interview, goes out to Zion, meets the guy here this past weekend. Guy says, we'll go flying. They go flying. Says, hey, I like what I see. Did you bring enough clothes with you to stay 2 weeks? Your first tour is in about an hour. And he said, no lie. He was out there the very next day, flying his first tour, and he goes, and it was completely hands-off. This particular manager is kind of interesting because he's, here are the keys, see you later. I got other things to do. And he goes, I'm left there with a helicopter going, okay, and people are standing around. That's how I did my first tour pretty much, and there was a secretary there that helped me out a little bit, but, I didn't even know where to get fuel.
Does he fly to St. George?
I don't know if it's not pronounced Hurricane, I don't think, but it's
I know where it is, yeah.
I can't think of how it's pronounced differently. It's spelled Hurricane.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Pronounced differently, I think.
I've gone to Zion a lot for climbing.
And this guy's a climber, too. So he's thrilled. Yeah. It's a seasonal job, but he's good to go. He's got his first job.
I'll have to get his names. I'll probably be back down there this fall. So, yeah, right now it's a good time to get hired in aviation. But let's get back to the program. Part of what I want to do, what came out of that for me, too, is he went through it fairly quickly. And
yeah.
There's an advantage towards if you start, finish. If you start, keep going with it. It's not aviation's not something you want to start, take 4 months off, come back to so much.
Right. And we, boy, if there's anything we are constantly on our students about is the importance of proficiency. From the day they walk in here and express an interest in the program, first we try to gauge, Is this person really interested in this program? Is this the passion for them, or is this a phase that's going to pass? Because it's an expensive experiment if that's the case. So what we'll do is we'll talk about it, say, our expectation is that when you're in the program here, there are essentially three aspects to it. There's the academic aspect where you'll be here at the campus and you'll be going to classes. We expect you to show up. We expect you to pass your classes. The practical training portion happens out at the airport. We expect you to be out there. We expect you to fly. Ideally, we want you out there 3-4 times a week at minimum, because we think that's the magic number that's going to get you to that proficiency that allow you to progress through the program, and graduate either on or ahead of schedule. And then a third aspect is the stuff that you got to do on your own, having the self-discipline to prepare for your FAA written exams and any of the other stuff, the research on, we'll help you with a lot of this stuff, but you have to be willing to put the time and the effort into it.
Need some self-motivation.
So, exactly. It's absolutely tangible data that we're operating from, and we can tell you, we can see the people that come in here, they're out there. Some go well beyond 3-4 times a week. Some people are living out at the airport. They're hitting their classes. They're out there every other waking moment. And those are the people that, the program is designed around to be completed in 2 years. But those are the people that show up, 18 months later, sometimes less than 18 months, and they're done. And they're ready to go and start out looking for a job. So it's all about that proficiency. Because to a student, we could ask them, how many times did you fly a week? Oh, I flew 4 times. I flew 5 times. Oh, I flew 6 times. Sometimes I flew twice a day later in the program. And those are the people that clearly excelled.
Right. And it's going to, the quicker you do it, the less it costs.
Absolutely.
And the sooner you're making money.
Absolutely.
Now, you are a 2-year program. You get an associate's degree out of it if you do the academics along with the flight portion. Can you split with your program? Can you split it and just do the flight portion and not get the academic side?
Technically, no. If somebody came in here and really had a desire to do that, we would probably, if that's what they wanted to do and they had the resources to do that, we would probably advise them to go Part 61 or to a Part 141 school and just pay by the hour. Go ahead or by the program.
Right.
The benefit in coming to a program like this is actually purposefully combining those two things. The thought is that it buys you several things. Number one, and maybe for some people most importantly, when you combine the academics with the practical training under the umbrella of a college in a degree-seeking program, that means that automatically the program qualifies for financial aid, and in the case of veterans benefits. As long as the student is enrolled in a degree-seeking program, even the practical portion of the training can be paid for. So veterans benefits will pay for everything because, again, it's captured in the degree. So if you come here as a, what we call in private pay, but a non-veteran student, they can, if they qualify for financial aid can be applied not only to their classes but to their flight fees. So financially, there's a huge benefit because you've already tapped into dollars you wouldn't ordinarily have available to you if you went to a Part 141 program or if you went Part 61.
So even as a non-veteran, there are going to be loans and grants of it, more loans and grants available to you since you're part of an education system.
Absolutely.
The Oregon.
Absolutely. Specifically, in this case, a degree program. So that's one of the benefits. The other benefit, depending on what discipline of flight you're interested in, if you're, for instance, interested in fixed-wing aviation and, you see yourself sometime in the future as an airline pilot, well, we all know that depending on how far you go in that industry, at some point you're going to come up against a ceiling if you don't have a four-year degree. So we're at least giving you a start towards your four-year degree. So that for those folks, there's clear benefit combining the degree, with the benefits of having additional funding available to them and on capturing it all. So 2 years or less is not necessarily an unreasonable or unmanageable investment in terms of time or money to get to where you're going to get to. Even if you went Part 61 or Part 141, yeah, you could do it quicker, probably even do it a little cheaper. But you're missing some of those other pieces at that point. Yeah, maybe you have bigger loans at that point, at the end of the day there. And you certainly don't have the degree.
Well, I went at it pretty hard when I was doing it. It took me about a year and a half, and I didn't get a degree out of it.
Right.
Now, you're mentioning Part 61, Part 91, Part 141. What's the difference between, what are those parts?
Well, as far as the FAA regulations go, the Federal Code of Regulations, or I should say, the Federal Aviation Regulations, Part 141, flight school, and we have our flight providers actually, in this case, and I think probably a good portion of the programs that are modeled like ours probably contract. If they don't own their own aircraft, they probably contract with providers who are designated a Part 141, which is basically a flight school, not a education facility like a Central Oregon Community College or, a University of North Dakota or Embry-Riddle, but down at the local airport, being able to go in and being able to pay X amount of dollars for a flight program within that you can expect to experience the structure of a school, because the FAA has basically blessed that program where you can go in and, they have a discernible syllabus and they have their syllabus that you'll walk through the different phases of flight. It's just a more standardized, more organized way of presenting that training, as opposed to Part 61, where I always look at that as the kick the tires and light the fires,
the
training. It's captured under the commercial requirements, which in some cases can save you money because they're you can actually save by not having to spend as much time in the air for some of the ratings. So you save, there could be potential savings there in some cases. But what we have found, and again, it's all about who's providing the training, but what we have found is that there are some really good, there's really some really good training available under Part 61, and there's some that maybe not. I mean, I've had students tell me that they were halfway through their ratings and they still day to day didn't know what to expect when they showed up to go flying.
Right.
And they were a little frustrated, especially people who were looking for that that organization. They didn't find it in that world. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just saying you have to be careful because it may or may not exist where you're trying to get your training.
So I'm going to throw in my two cents here. Part 61, if you get an awesome instructor, could be really good.
Yeah.
But you're... Like when I was getting my ratings, I switched instructors several times, and I finally found a guy that I really liked. Although the guy I ended up with my private, I liked quite a bit too. But then I switched to a Part 61. That was great. But with a 141 program, you've got a much clearer idea of what you're going to get.
Right.
It's all laid out. So you don't have to have that worry about when you start, is this a good instructor? You just have there's more of a guarantee that it's going to be a standardized program.
Right, absolutely. And the other thing I think... Again, for somebody who needs the structure, it's a lot better. Yeah, the other thing too is that I'm not so sure that there's any proof to this, but I think students that go through a Part 141, something in me believes that if their first job is going to be an instructor, they possibly will be a better instructor for it. Again, unless they're lucky enough to grasp or get a hold of the one Part 61 instructor that was super, you know, organized and walked them through something that they could emulate when they are turn around to be an instructor.
Right.
But through Part 141, at least everybody's got a fighting chance of understanding, hey, you start at A, you get to Z, and there's a way to get there, and that's the way we're going to that's the way I'm going to teach when I start doing it.
Well, and the reality is if your first job's flight instructor, you've got 300-350 hours, and suddenly you're teaching someone, it would be nice to have structure because you can deal with the actual sitting in the airplane instructing
right.
somebody. And, you know, if you've got a couple thousand hours, you're going to be more relaxed in the airplane. But if you don't have to worry about your lesson plans as much, that's kind of laid out, that would be
right.
nice when you start
right.
off.
Absolutely.
In terms of a four-year degree, I'll throw in my two cents here, too, because I don't have a four-year degree. So there's proof you don't need it. Probably depending where you are in your life when you start into aviation, I would have a very hard time telling you that there wasn't a good reason to get a four-year degree or a two-year degree that can turn into it. I know people that have had associates and then they finish up their four-year degrees online.
Right.
And it's just, in aviation, it gives you options later on.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I would agree with you on the point that there's tons of things you can do in aviation that you don't require a four-year degree and possibly not even a two-year degree. There's
right.
no question about that. When I mentioned that about the degree issue, I'm just thinking specifically
absolutely.
Major airlines.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because that's just one, again, it's only one facet of aviation. But if somebody comes here and says, that's what I want to do, that's the way we advise them. We just like, hey, well, you need to be thinking about, you know, education beyond here because... And even if you can sneak in the back door some way, which in the major airlines, I don't think there's even a way of doing that any longer. But and when I say major, I'm talking, you know, United, Delta, American.
Yeah.
Your competition, you got to be thinking about them too. Even if you're going someplace where you don't think it's a requirement, you got to start thinking about what your competition is going to have. And I think when you start getting to that level, even if it wasn't required, even at the commuter airlines, it's not required, but I guarantee you most of your competition is going to have bachelor's degrees at the even at that level, maybe even master's in some cases.
And often they get so many applications, they're looking for reasons to disqualify
exactly.
people right off
yeah.
the bat without
right.
talking to them. No, yeah. I think a degree's... when you start off in your career, you know, especially if you're in your low 20s, mid-20s, you don't really know where you're going to end up. If you want to get into management, you know, degree's just not going to hurt you.
Right,
absolutely. That's a great reason to do a program that has a degree with it. And Part 61 schools you can find at most small airports, and I certainly like a lot of aspects of those. Part 141 schools you can find here and there, but there aren't that many there are fewer aviation programs associated with an organized state college system. This would be one here in Bend with COCC. And then you've got the only one I know in Oregon is Lane Community College in Eugene.
Lane, actually, in Portland Community College has
okay.
one as well. They're associated with Hillsborough Aviation over there. They've been around quite a while, actually. And there are others. You know, they're all over the country. But the interesting thing about it is, and now we're talking about two-year colleges.
Exactly. We'll go on to four-year later
right.
on.
The they're If you get on the internet and do some searches, you'll find a lot will come up. The difference between them is the way they've designed their programs or the model they've used. Like I say, we have a model here where everything you do, if you came here and you said, hey, I'm interested in the aviation program, I'd like to go to Central Oregon Community College. But whether it's here or Portland Community College, pretty much the same thing because we've set up the same models. You would register for everything that you would enroll at the college. Once you're enrolled and you're a student here and you say, okay, my major is aviation, in this case, maybe, you know, professional pilot airplane. That's my major. At the end of those 2 years, I have enough classes, enough credits to have a 2-year degree. I have enough hours and I have all the ratings I need to go out and, you know, get an entry level job in the industry. Everything you did during those 2 years is done through the college. You pay for your tuition through the college. You pay for your flight fees through the college, your books, all that. Everything is done through the college. That model demands a lot of administrative oversight on the part of the college because the college becomes a broker for all that cash that's not sitting at the college. It's going out to the flight providers because, as you well know, and anybody out there that's ever paid for a single hour in an airplane or helicopter, it's expensive. So the 2/3 of the cost, probably more like 3/4 of the cost of this program, goes through the hands of Central Oregon Community College and winds up out at the flight providers paying for all those flight fees. So a lot of colleges are not willing to accept that level of administrative oversight or that level of administrative work to make the program happen. So you a program like this, you come in and you say, okay, yeah, that works great. That's exactly what I want to do. You go halfway across the country and find another community college that advertises an aviation program, and they say, yeah, well, you'll do all your academics here, but you'll have to go work out all your flight stuff with the provider out there.
Separate.
Correct. And now the danger in falling to one of those programs is, again, because remember what I said earlier, if you're trying to use financial aid or you're a veteran with veterans benefits, they will not pay for the flight portion because it's not part of the degree program. So that's what you have to watch for. Different models, because I would argue there are probably a dozen, maybe even more out there. I haven't looked lately, but I know there are quite a few across the country. They're just not all set up the same way.
Okay, so that's something to... that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So now moving on to like the 4-year colleges, you mentioned University of South Dakota.
North Dakota.
North Dakota, let's get it backwards.
Yeah.
And Embry-Riddle, there are a few... I only know of a few that have 4-year programs. They're usually very expensive.
They are.
Do you see a... I've got my own opinion on this, and I think an advantage to doing a 4-year program with like an Embry-Riddle or a North Dakota versus a 2-year, I mean, is there...
I'd say there's an advantage if they have something very specific that they offer that you're after.
Okay.
And because they do. Like Embry-Riddle, for instance, I think has 8 or 9 different degree options.
Right.
Clearly, we're not going to have that here at the two-year level. You know, we have basically a couple 3 degrees. There is some little room for growth, but we're never going to reach that level where we have the demand for that kind of curriculum. So if you're out, if your goal was you want to be an aeronautical engineer or you want to be involved in, you know, airport management or something like that, they have tracks that'll take you down that road. We do not. So maybe if it's something very specific, I would see benefit. The problem that I have with it is the same problem I have with it with higher level education in general. It's way overpriced. So if you ask me, would you get a quality aviation education at University of North Dakota or Embry-Riddle, I'd probably say, yes, you would. Then I'd probably say, how much is education worth? You know, I don't care where you're going to school. At some point, $50,000 is too much to pay for education.
For a year.
You know, yeah. Exactly. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
You're right. You know, $50,000 a year is I think... it's too much to pay. Because 20 years ago, were we producing any worse pilots 20 years ago from some of these programs than we are today? I would say no. I probably had just as good pilots back then as we have now. So what's changed that all of a sudden it costs twice as much to go to some of these places? So I'm not happy with the cost.
Right.
But if that particular organization has something very specific that you want, I'd say that's probably the best way to get it, because not only will you get what you want, it's going to be internationally recognized if you come out of one of those places. That's the benefit.
That's what I was going to say. I think the education of those places is pretty high. I think it's very good. I mean, I think they're good organizations, and they are recognized. Like on a resume, everyone's going to recognize Embry-Riddle, University of North Dakota. But I've talked to a fair number of students now, too, and $180,000 in debt when they get out. The cost is very high. Yeah. It's like an Ivy League school.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Kind of backing up then, what are you, so something with an associate program, like what would be a general cost of going here?
So again, right, currently we have two disciplines. We're just about to introduce an unmanned aerial systems track as well, but right now we have helicopter and airplane. For the airplane, we're right around $70,000, maybe, you know, give or take a few dollars, again depending on your proficiency, how quickly you go through the program. On the helicopter side, it's closer to $90,000.
And that's with the two-year degree?
That's with the two-year degree. It's two-year degree, the requisite number of hours, as you mentioned earlier, in the fixed-wing side, you know, 350, you know, give or take 350 hours. Helicopter side, you need a little less, about right around the 200 level. So you're the requisite number of hours you need, all your ratings, and that includes on the helicopter side, you know, private, instrument, commercial, CFI, II. On the fixed-wing side, the same ratings with the additional options of multi-engine, private multi, commercial multi, and MEI. And there's some endorsements wrapped up in there as well. On the helicopter side, you can get a night vision goggle endorsement. We expose students to mountain flying and long line flying. On the airplane side, you'll have to by demand of the requirements, you'll have to be exposed to to complex aircraft naturally, but in addition to that, we try to put people through some technically advanced training where they get to actually, you know, play around with some what I would call state-of-the-art digital systems on the aircraft, so they can are exposed to that. We're looking at introducing a unusual attitude recovery aspect of the program. Huh. So there are different things that you'll get. You'll get those kind of along the way, but the basic ratings will all be there. So the hours, the ratings, the degree. And that's what the $70,000 or $90,000 buys you.
Do you have an? I've got. I'm always telling people if they want rotorcraft, they should still do fixed wing first, and then do rotorcraft as an add-on. You're a rotorcraft guy. Do you think that's? Am I right on that?
Actually, I'm dual rated. I don't fly, and I have not flown, you know, fixed wing for a long, long time. But I would agree with you. I got my training through the Navy. Even though I was Coast Guard actually uses the Naval Flight Program for their training.
Okay.
And the Naval Flight Training's model is just that. Everybody goes to fixed wing first. Back in my day, we were flying, a Beechcraft Turbomentor. So nice little aircraft, low wing design. So they put you straight into something that's really a little bit on the unstable side, because they want it to be more maneuverable, so you're a little bit on the unstable side. Plenty of power to get you out of trouble in case, you know, when they throw you in that aircraft, you're going to be doing a lot of crazy things for somebody who's just learned how to fly. So they want you to be able to get out of whatever you get yourself into, I guess. But they do that. I'm sure that was researched and it was done with intent. So whether you're going to be a helicopter pilot, a prop guy or a woman or a jet pilot, you all start out doing fixed-wing aviation. So all the basics were laid out for me, and then after that, you know, transitioned to helicopters, and I have to believe that made it easier. So, right. And it'll make it cheaper. That's another thing, too. If you're looking at the possibility of a dual rating in your future, if you do that airplane stuff first, knowing that the airplane ratings are cheaper right up front,
right.
When you go over to the helicopter side, well, now you're talking about, you know, okay, maybe you have to do one rating or two ratings, standalone ratings, but you can do add-ons. All of a sudden, you have cut that $90,000 program down possibly in half.
Right.
Depending on how much you got accomplished on the fixed-wing side.
So if you did a fixed-wing rating, and that's 60, 70 grand, and then you moved on to add a rotorcraft, you might end up only being 100 grand into two ratings, being dual rating.
Correct, yeah. I mean, it's possible. Again, proficiency is everything, but those are clearly the benefits. And I think that, you know, it's not just the legal aspect of having those other ratings so that I can apply those to my next series of ratings in the helicopter. It's the fact that you built all that proficiency, those basic skills up, your basic air work, your instrument skills, they're already done.
Well, even just I had a friend who did just rotorcraft, and he was talking about getting his instrument rating. And, you know, he's trying to read the charts while he's flying the helicopter, and I'm thinking, man, you know, that it would be easier if you learned just the basic airmanship, just what the ground looks like from the air. you know, locating your, you know, where you are.
Oh, absolutely.
Patterns, radio work, and a plane which is more stable.
Yep.
And you can take the hands off your controls.
Yeah, I believe that definitely was, again, the Coast Guard, the Navy, and the Marine Corps all use that same model, and apparently it works.
Huh. So now, since we were talking about cost, and you probably don't have a firm number on that, I don't think there is a firm number, actually. If somebody had a degree and they just want to get their ratings, if they went 61, how cheap do you think someone could bundle all there if they really just were trying to price it out?
I think you could probably do it for maybe as much as 20% cheaper than our program.
Okay.
I mean, because, again, you're not worried about any of the academic stuff. And again, I hate to sound like a broken record, but we're going to come back to the same thing, depending on how you can maintain your proficiency.
Right, yeah.
So, again, if you're out there and you come with the money and you come with intent and you say, okay, my job for the next 6 months or 8 months or 12 months, whatever, is going to be flying. 5 days a week I'm going to be out there doing it. That's how the military does it. That's why they can pump pilots through the equivalent of all those ratings in about a year.
Right.
Because that's your job. It's your only job.
They're doing it. Complex aircraft kind of stuff.
Correct. I would absolutely think 20% would be a fair assessment of what you would do, how much you could save doing it that way.
That's kind of, that actually matches what I was thinking. I was thinking you'd be 40 grand or so, somewhere in that range.
Yeah.
What do you think of those programs? You see them in aviation magazines, you know, 6 months, zero time, the commercial. Do you know much about those?
I've never experienced one. I thought when I went to military flight school and doing it all in a year was like drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that I just had a brother, and I have an older brother who just decided, you know, late in life that he was going to decide he was going to be a private pilot. And he actually enrolled in one of those programs. And about 3 weeks into the program, he walked away from it. He walked away for two reasons. One is that he didn't know if he made the right choice in the school, but the other reason was that he felt that there was so much put on him. And this is a pretty bright guy. He said, "I didn't feel I was safe to do what they were asking me to do."
Oh, wow. Okay.
He goes, "I realized this is after I was flying my fourth or fifth day in a particular week, and you know, I forgot to switch the fuel. And next thing I know, I almost ran myself out of fuel, not understanding what I was doing."
Yeah.
And this is after 30 or 40 hours, because it's maybe there are people who actually do well in that environment, but he goes, I didn't think it was for me, so he stopped.
Basically, what you're saying with these really compressed programs, it's almost too much stuff. You can't assimilate the knowledge that you're getting.
Right, I think enough. So. And it's funny, because I ran this, I was working recently, the gentleman... I'm trying to think, does he work for the FAA? He doesn't work for the FAA, but he's most recently, one of the big things the FAA has been pushing is the concept of scenario-based training. And so I ran into this gentleman who was teaching scenario-based training, and I asked him the same question, essentially, because I just had this recent experience with my brother having gone through this program. And so I asked him, pretty much, so what do you think? And he said, think about what we're trying to do here today. He said, you know, he's talking in relationship to the training he was putting on. So we're teaching you to go out, and when you have a student with you, we're teaching you to use scenarios every time you introduce something to the student. So the student can, number one, have a kind of a real-time picture of what's going on out there, what they're experiencing, you know, in the actual flying environment. And on top of that, more importantly, you're going to teach the student to make their own decisions. So they're not growing up in an environment where somebody else has done everything for them, thought everything for them, told them what to do. Start them out right from the beginning learning that, no, this is you. You need to make that decision. You need to fly this aircraft. And he said, I don't see how they could capture that in a compressed program. A compressed program can only be successful if they're teaching maneuver-based training. You memorize steps 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
You're going to see how to do it in the aircraft, and we're going to make you do it enough times so you can get away. You can actually reach the level of proficiency that we want you to have, and then we're going to move on to the next thing.
It's rote learning.
Exactly. So at the end of the day, yes, maybe you were good enough to get through that, but what do you have the do you have the situational awareness? Do you have that level of experience that you would have had if you went through a program over the course of a year or 2 years, where you've seen a couple of them? Maybe you've had a few emergency procedures along the way. You've done something that you can actually
think through what's happening and what you need to do to fix the problem.
Right.
And things do happen outside of what we're trained to do. And then, but if you have a good broad knowledge, you can It's climbing too. You know, if something starts going wrong, often you haven't trained for that exact scenario, but you start thinking, what skills do I have? You know, what arrows do I have in my quiver?
Right.
And the more arrows you have in that quiver, the more likely you are to be able to get yourself.
Absolutely. And so this gentleman who actually had at one point worked for the FAO, now was teaching the scenario-based training, and been around for a long time, had a lot of hours, and his opinion was those programs cannot produce the same level of pilot that you would produce from whether it was a 141 or a 61 or a program like ours.
Okay, interesting. Back to your drone program. I know you're just implementing it, so you don't have it really hammered down. But the one thing I did want to hit on, to go through the drone program, you've got to go through the fixed wing or rotorcraft program. It's basically an add-on to a commercial rating.
Yeah, that's one way. I never really thought of putting it that way, but I guess you could argue that that's kind of what it is. I mean, and that's really, you know, we're all here. We're playing the guessing game a little bit since the FAA hasn't really come out with what their hardcore regulations are going to be for incorporating unmanned aerial systems into U.S. airspace. But all indications are from industry, the people who are out there kind of waiting at the door to actually break into this commercial industry, are believing that the FAA is going to have a requirement that includes some level of pilot certification, practical pilot certification. We're believing, you know, commercial and instrument rated makes sense. At some point in the future, we believe possibly the actual term commercial might start applying to some different set of criteria when it comes to unmanned aerial systems than we know it in either the airplane or the helicopter world. So maybe that's what it'll change to. But initially, we don't have that information. So our program that we're developing here incorporates, again, the commercial and instrument level in either airplane or rotary wing, and then unmanned aerial systems classes on top of that, which are heavily weighted in simulation, because essentially that's what industry's doing now. They're training their own people right now, the people who are deployed all over the world that are flying these things on contract. They're really going through a program that gets them about 80 hours of simulation, some information on maintenance, and some computer skills, because everything's done at a keyboard or at a computer, and you're programming where to go, what to do, when to come back, and then you're just monitoring things. The days of even hand flying these things, according to the operators that I've spoken to, are pretty much gone. Uh-huh. You have a joystick there, but you almost never touch it.
You're really plugging it all in a computer.
It's understanding, you know, mission planning and mission execution via a keyboard.
And from what I understand now, there is no FAA rating for UAVs at all.
No, not currently. It's it's approved it's approved only on a case by case basis by the FAA, and so far not for commercial purposes.
Right.
So law enforcement, for instance, is one of those areas. Research and development, maybe a little bit, but it's very, very heavily regulated right now. And I believe that. That's going to change, but I think it's going to be incremental. They're not going to just kind of throw caution to the wind and say, okay, everybody can go fly, UAVs wherever they want now. I think that what they require based on certifications or based on skill sets is going to partially be determined by, well, what are you flying and where are you flying it?
Well, and right now you actually get, just the way I understand it, when you do go fly for a company, you get trained in a system.
Like, correct.
So it's not like you don't learn how to fly UAVs. You learn how to fly the Predator. You know, just you learn how to fly that specific.
Absolutely correct.
Aircraft.
Yeah. So I mean, our goal in our program is what these companies are doing right now is they're commercializing a lot of their existing platforms and their existing training. So we're hoping to tap into that, incorporate that type of training here. So yeah, maybe our student is not going to train on the Predator because it doesn't buy the student marketability. They maybe need to be training on some other platform. But really what we want is when we set up our simulation is designed to have multiple platforms.
Right.
So you're not just building necessarily a future I don't know if we use company names or not, but a company XYZ employee, it's an employee who could potentially go anywhere and say, okay, I have background in this number of platforms. And
maybe do differences training for a specific.
Right, and the different scenarios that we'll use, you know, we're going to use all commercial-based scenarios. So, you know, wildland firefighting, search and rescue, you know, farming or agriculture. I mean, we're going to tap into all the potential areas that somebody could actually see themselves working in, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road.
That was the next question. What jobs do you see these UAVs performing? And you hit wildland firefighting. You picked some of them.
I think it's almost endless. I mean, if I had to look at a list here, I see, you know, things like, you know, there are security issues, Arctic research, firefighting, construction, and I mean, I throw some of these terms out, and you'll see what application would have. Well, you start thinking back, you know, even a real estate agent, for instance. Well, I can take aerial shots of all my houses and my properties,
patrol.
And right. Oh yeah, pipeline patrol. You know, the power line patrols. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So I think there are all sorts of applications. And the thing is, when you talk about all those different type of jobs, those jobs would cover anything from a small hand-launched UAS or UAV to a larger, more robust all-weather, you know, system that could mount all kinds of different sensors on it, depending on what you're doing. So, and I think that's also going to be the varying levels of the industry from an employment standpoint. You're not going to make $100,000 as if you've just been hired to go out to some farmer's field to take some pictures of his cattle herd.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, you may be making $100,000 if you're flying for a law enforcement agency, and you're doing heavy duty surveillance, and so I think the opportunities are pretty wide ranging. And the other part of this, because we talk about pilots here. You know, what's happened in my future? What's happened in my job? You just told me to come to your program and be a helicopter pilot. I think the things we're talking about, I think there's a place for both.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the long-term potential impact to the traditional aviation industry, is it out there? Yes. Is it out there in the immediate future? Probably not. I mean, if you think the reality of the FAA allowing a large unmanned system into controlled airspace, I just don't see it happening in the next year, 2, 5, maybe not even 10.
And probably anything with passengers on board.
Right.
It's probably you're going to always have a person in front.
I mean, we're talking really, and maybe I'll put my foot in my mouth, but I think it's pretty futuristic. You know, just imagine yourself getting on something the size of a 747. There's no pilots up front. I just don't see it. Culturally, I don't think we're ready for it. There's no market there.
I think it's cultural, but I think you're right. I think the aircraft could fly just fine without anybody up front.
Yeah, maybe better. You wouldn't overpass airports all the time.
Although it was interesting listening to the gentleman you had in here earlier talk about some of these UAVs, and I was surprised at some of the tales. I thought there'd be closer to being a real the person operating. I'm going to put my foot in my mouth. Operating would be more like a real pilot. Like they'd be watching a camera.
I understand what you're saying. And that's our standpoint too, is we agree with the model that includes part of your training being a practical pilot, or have a practical pilot training. We think that's a good idea. I mean, I think you could make a similar argument. You know, I got my basic training in fixed wing, but I flew helicopters my whole career. Well, that background gave me a better opportunity and a better transition position into helicopters. Well, if you know something about aviation, why would it not give you a better transition into a field where you were going to be operating a vehicle, even though not behind the controls of that vehicle, literally, in the air? It seems to make sense. And the way we're advising our students as well. And I think what's going to be a surprise to people is that, you know, they see this new big industry and you know, large potential for jobs, until they pick up the phone and make that call and realize that there's a whole other element to this, and part of it may include you being an actual pilot. And I think that that may deter some people because of, again, now you'd incorporate that expense back into the training. On the other hand, you know, I look at it as, hey, you're that much more diversified.
Well, and also you may get a UAV job that pays a decent amount, and maybe you go buy your own plane if you like flying.
True.
And there's a big difference between actually physically flying an airplane and flying a computer.
And the other thing, you know, you talk about that first job. When you start talking about, we all know, when you're 98% of us that go through, that get our pilot certifications, be it airplane or helicopter, we're going to be relegated to an instructor job. And that instructor job is probably going to pay somewhere between $15 and $20 an hour. Not so in the UAV industry.
Right.
You may walk into a $50,000 job. If you go overseas, you may walk into a $100,000 job. The people who are doing that now, they're not especially, they're not highly educated in the sense that they don't have doctorates or master's degrees. They weren't required to have all kinds of pilot certifications. They were people that walked off the street, maybe had some military background, maybe not, paid $30,000 for some training, and walked directly into a $100,000 job, as long as they were willing to deploy. In some cases, you know, if you don't want to go to Afghanistan, maybe you're not going to make $100,000.
Right.
But the potential of walking directly into a high-paying job that field is very high.
When we said earlier, even in the military, you might have an E-5 flying a drone.
Right.
Whereas a fighter pilot is always going to be an officer. There's some warrant officer programs. There's usually the rotorcraft in the Army that I know about.
Right.
But almost any fixed-wing position in the military is going to be an officer or college degree, whereas the drone programs, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, absolutely true.
And that's not to say anything about it. When I was enlisted in the military, it's more of how much training they're putting into that person. You know,
sure.
A fighter pilot takes 2 years to train. It's a long process.
It can be a year, 18 months, yeah, at minimum. And, you know, their expectation of that particular pilot or officer, if you will, is much more far ranging than just flying that aircraft.
Right.
Ultimately, they're expecting to move into a position of leadership and management, and
you know,
senior officer. So there's a whole plan for that. But
10-year contracts.
Exactly. And in some cases, you know, honestly, there's a point where you are no longer the expert in your field. It's a secondary thing.
Right.
And you sign up for that, and you understand that, and that's the way it is. You know, so for people out there that are thinking of going the military route, go into it with your eyes open and understand that there's some jobs that, you know, your job is to fly, and there are others that the service views that as your secondary job. So you just have to understand that.
And we're going to sit down with Carl later and talk about the Coast Guard career. We don't have time to do that today, but it's a good excuse to come down to Bend, which brings up another thing with flight school would be location. Is people might say location's not that important, but I wouldn't argue that it actually is. Not, and Bend's great, not just because you have good skiing and climbing, and Bend's awesome, but you have good weather,
right?
And altitude issues too.
At least those very two issues. If you're out there shopping for a program, whether it's a program like ours or a Part 141 program, any flight program, I would definitely consider taking a look into where is it located, because if you can capture higher elevations, meaning higher density altitude flying automatically, because just by virtue of being at 3,000 or 4,000 feet, or in some cases maybe even higher, depending on where the school is, I would definitely consider that, because that higher elevation training demands a high level of attention to detail, a high level of understanding of how your systems operate and how they'll be affected by those higher altitudes. That will make you a better pilot. There's no question about it. I look at people who fly Robinson R-22s here, very power-limited aircraft. It's a wonderful training aircraft, low cost of maintenance, keeps helicopter training at least within reach for some people.
Right.
But, you know, when you put it at a higher elevation, it's a demanding helicopter to fly. So if you've trained yourself to fly at that helicopter at this elevation, you're probably going to be fine. If you get down to sea level and you're doing tours in a R-22 or an R-44 down on the beach.
May be your first job.
Yeah,
like
absolutely. And then you mentioned the weather part, you know, so here in Central Oregon, you know, give or take, we advertise about 300 flying days a year. I would say that's fairly accurate. I mean, this has been a harsh winter for us, and even as harsh as this has been, rare occasion that you go any more than a day or two without flying because of weather. So, again, nice climate. you know, and then the terrain as well. So you have here, we're just a stone's throw from 10,000 foot mountains. So the opportunity to understand, you know, mountain weather and just the mountain environment in general, the terrain and the thought process that goes, well, if I'm transiting mountainous areas, you know, what am I thinking about as opposed to flying up a beach line or whatever?
Oh, and looking at the mare's tails or lenticular and saying, what's the turbulence going
to
be like?
Exactly. We're learning to read the weather around the mountains and understand how that's going to affect you all. So, and there are locations throughout the country, you know, Utah has some flight schools that are solid in the middle of mountainous environments. You know, we're lucky enough here to probably have, I would argue, possibly the only one, and if not on the West Coast, certainly in the Northwest, that can advertise that kind of environment.
Right, and at the same time, you get the advantage of having the clear weather. You fly more consistently when you're scheduled, which won't lead to as many scheduling conflicts, which can happen at all flight schools. There's a limited number of aircraft available. And then I've did all my flying on the west side of the mountains in Oregon. Right. And in the wintertime, you'd go a week, 2 weeks, where you'd show up, you know, I'd drive down the airport and would be just, you know, it'd be a 200-foot ceiling.
Right.
You're just not going anywhere. Now, the advantage of that was I'd get out and during instrument rating, you'd actually fly actual instrument stuff, but you still lose days because you're in a 172. If there's icing, you're a student pilot. You're not going to go blasting off when you've got the possibility of ice occurring. anything else you'd like to add? I think that covered...
Yeah, we covered a lot.
Pretty well, yeah.
Covered a lot. I mean, I'm more than happy to talk again about, you know, the other stuff, the military end of it or the Coast Guard end of it. That's fine, too, so we can hit that another time.
I'd love to. But like I said, the first interview I did was NOAA pilots, and I guess they can actually fly, and they can go fly for the Navy.
They can fly a couple different ways.
And I've been wanting to get more into the military, because the military can be a great way to launch a civilian career. It can be a career on its own. They're pluses and minuses to that, I think. So we'll talk about that more. As I said earlier, I think Coast Guard is one of the better ways to actually fly a lot if you're in the military.
Yeah, it is. And we can't talk about that again, but of the services, outside of being a chief warrant officer helicopter pilot in the Army, I could probably make an argument that the Coast Guard is one of the organizations that will allow you to fly a substantial amount actually throughout your entire career. You are expected to do other things at some point, but the operational piece of here is stays very high because it's, you know, it's a mission. You're serving the public, and it's a mission that has to be done, kind of like being a fireman. You have to go out and fight fires no matter whatever your other jobs are there, and the same thing with the Coast Guard. You're going to have to go out and fly no matter what other jobs you have at your air station.
That's work you can always feel good about doing.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
You're literally rescuing people. You're saving people's lives.
Yeah, lives and property.
So, cool. All right, we won't go into that. We'll be here all night.
Okay.
So, thanks for taking the time.
Appreciate that.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.